Hello and welcome to episode 4 of Is It Funny? This week's episode will be mostly about Beyond the Fringe and largely about Peter Cook because that's unavoidable. It may only be part 1 of Beyond the Fringe too. First, there was Monty Python. Monty Python led me to records, looking for Monty Python records, and then finding other things that were related. And one of the first ones was A Poke in the Eye with a Sharp Stick, which was the LP commemorating the first charity concert for Amnesty International. It was later filmed and recorded as something called Pleasure at Her Majesty's because it was at Her Majesty's Theater. And there was a lot of overlap between those two things. And I'm pretty sure, and again, here is where, you know, never trust memory, but I'm pretty sure that came first. And then I found the first LP for Beyond the Fringe, which for a long time was the only way that I knew it. Pleasure at Her Majesty introduced me to not only Peter Cook, but also Eleanor Braun and John Fortune, who are also in it. Maybe Neil Innes, or maybe Neil Innes was at a later one, and Rowan Atkinson, who I didn't know anything about too. So it's all connected, and many of the same people keep showing up in the same names. And yes, there'll definitely be an episode about Eleanor Braun, and probably Eleanor Braun's work with John Fortune as well. And then there's John Byrd, who's always in my mind. Still sometimes gets confused, John Byrd, John Fortune, people with the same first name, I'm often confused about. Beyond the Fringe is really the starting point for what was known as the satire boom. And this in 1962, and certainly there were things before it, this is really where it took off, the satire boom, in large part because of the success of Beyond the Fringe. If you want to read more about the satire boom, there's certainly Humphrey Carpenter's book, A Great Silly Grin. There's also From Fringe to Flying Circus, which is by Roger Wilmot. And it really talks about the sort of path that became a kind of pipeline for British comedy for certainly during the 60s, which was the Footlights Club in Cambridge that led to these kinds of reviews that often went to the West End and then went straight to BBC, sometimes as writers, sometimes as performers. And Peter Cook was certainly one of the people who followed this kind of path. In fact, by the time he was 18 years old, as I think I mentioned in the last episode, he was already writing and being paid to write comedy. And most notably for a piece called Pieces of Eight, which was for Kenneth Williams and Fenella Fielding. And so he felt rather well on the way on his career, even though he was still supposed to be training to enter the Foreign Service, something we have in common because I was at one point supposed to go into the State Department. And I don't know if it's an interesting tale or not, so I'll save that for some other time. So the satire boom. It was not just irreverent. It was really poking quite directly at the establishment, which is why Peter Cook later bought a club and called it that. Beyond the Fringe came about because of this kind of low budget approach to creating content for not only for the festival at Edinburgh, which is where Beyond the Fringe started out, but also in moving shows to the West End with the kind of safety net of having this Oxbridge connection, because these things often come about because people knew each other. And this is, you know, this is really where that class consciousness comes together. When we think about the sort of beginning of Beyond the Fringe, one of the people responsible was John Bassett, who was assistant to the chief of the Edinburgh Festival, Robert Ponsonby, an old Etonian, and Bassett's wife, I think it was, knew Jonathan Miller. And so there were connections there sort of behind the scene. The genesis of the idea was to deal with the kind of competition they were getting from the Fringe Festival. So the Edinburgh Festival itself wanted to get some of the elements that were taking over in the Fringe and bring them to the sort of main stages there. So this kind of competition, they thought they could bring together these undergraduate performers for a relatively inexpensive way to try out this new idea. And in fact, not just students, but students who are already on their way to careers. The four in Beyond the Fringe, Peter Cook, of course, Jonathan Miller, Alan Bennett, and Dudley Moore. Alan Bennett and Jonathan Miller were already like, okay, well, we've had our sort of comedy fun time as undergraduates, and now we're going to be serious and go into our careers. Jonathan Miller, whom many people know for a variety of things that he dabbled in through his life, and of course, because he was a man, he was called a polymath, not a dabbler. But Jonathan Miller was already in medical school and was pretty sure that he was going to give up on this comedy thing. And Alan Bennett, while he had enjoyed to some extent performing, was very serious about getting into his career as a medieval historian. Dudley Moore, since he had gone to Oxford on a scholarship for playing the organ, was much more interested in sort of the performance side of it. And Peter Cook, as I've already mentioned, had already had a good start on being a professional in the comedy world. John Bassett's idea of sort of bringing them all together for this performance, combining two from Cambridge, and it was in fact Jonathan Miller who had recommended John Bassett get in touch with Peter Cook, and then the two from Oxford, Alan Bennett and Dudley Moore, who were a little more subdued on the whole. In fact, all four of them really meeting up for the first time in London near the hospital where Jonathan Miller worked. It was a little bit of a difficulty sort of feeling out how things would go. And in fact, there's a really great story of that very first meeting in the restaurant, which nobody can quite remember. Was it an Indian restaurant? Was it an Italian restaurant? But everybody agreed the food was really terrible. Now I'm going to read a little bit from the biography of Peter Cook written by Harry Thompson, which is largely pretty good. If the biographer starts out with an assumption of here is the arc of the person's life, then they tend to find evidence to fit that arc. And I think a lot of people sold Peter Cook short on the end of his life because it was like, oh, he's just lost everything and he has no ability left. And clearly his appearances on Clive Anderson showed that was not the case. But anyway, so the first meeting of the four who would become Beyond the Fringe, Miller, Bennett, and Moore all later confessed to John Bassett that they had gone to the meeting apprehensive about who would crack the first joke. They need not have worried. Miller recounts how, quote, as soon as Peter sat down at lunch, this flow of uncontrollably inventive stuff came out of him. It was impossible to compete with him. You couldn't actually participate. There was no room for one to get in. One simply had to be an audience of it. It was very exhausting. Even when, in fact, you were helpless with laughter, you longed for it to finish, not merely because you were exhausted by the laughter, but because there seemed to be no prospect of it coming to an end at all. He seemed very threatening to us all in that respect. Alan Bennett, who barely spoke a word, had similar misgivings. I had the slight feeling I was there under false pretenses, a feeling that never really left me. Peter was very funny and, to my alarm, very fluent. He appeared to be able to ad-lib excellent material in monologues of spiraling absurdity. Moore was feeling, if anything, even more cowed. I was completely mute in front of these intellectual giants. I felt I was just there to supply music more than anything. They were all 6'2". I was 5'2", which made a great deal of difference. So maybe not the most propitious of starts, but start they did. And there was no real sort of organizing principle behind things. They all came from very different sort of backgrounds, and which figured in the show to some extent. And to begin with, they only needed an hour of material. Miller and Bennett were the ones who were more keen on actually doing real satire. But it was Peter Cook who did the Macmillan sketch, and the Lord Chamberlain, whose office censored all plays that appeared on the West End. Censored one of the bits, the Bollard cigarettes sequence, because of use of terminology. Anything referring to homosexuality was forbidden. There were completely different kinds of sketches included in the review, as it was, including Jonathan Miller's fantastic Shakespeare sketch, which is one of the few that really captures the feel of Shakespeare in an almost beautiful way, and then occasionally undercutting it with, you know, very good humor and sometimes very silly humor. There's a wonderful line sort of near the end of the bit that is, "Oh, saucy Worcester," which pays off really well, especially after all the very, you know, elevated language. Alan Bennett did his famous sermon, and of course, Dudley Moore did in fact play the piano and played very witty and very entertaining spoofs and inspirations from well-known songs. They had one sort of last-minute problem that Actors Equity was going to demand that Peter Cooke change his name because there was a Peter Cooke, C-O-K-E, currently in Equity. And his first suggestion for an alternate name was Javier Blamange, which they did not accept. And then there was Wardrobe, Ebenezer, and Sting Thundercock. And so I guess they finally gave up on it. The final track listing that's on the LP, which is my first experience of this, is Ballard, which is the cigarette ad, which is very, very camp actors preparing, you know, in very, you know, sort of what we would consider very cliched, sort of very lovey, if you know the term. And then, of course, when the recording is rolling, that they all become very butch and Ballard, it's a man's cigarette. The next bit is a sketch that has to do with working for the tabloids, which, of course, Lord Beaverbrook was very well known at the time. And it's about sort of having that kind of integrity. And Alan Bennett's character, of course, saying, well, you know, I gave all that up because you know, I couldn't possibly continue doing it. And Peter Cook's character saying, well, that's great, you know, but we don't all come into 100,000 on our 21st birthday, so that we can't possibly give it up. Dudley Moore's Deutsche Chansons, which is a very good sort of Kurt Weill impressions and very dramatic and singing all the parts in these different voices and playing it. Alan Bennett's Take a Pew, which is absolutely delightful monologue of this minister trying to work his way around the very normal sort of picking a Bible verse at random and then building a sermon around it. And of course, the Bible verse that he's chosen is, "But my brother Esau is a hairy man and I am a smooth man." And then trying to create these elaborate parables to relate to it and experiences, mountain climbing in Scotland with a friend and climbing to the top of the peak. And then my friend very suddenly and violently vomited. And I think this, you know, relates back to this, "But my brother Esau was a hairy man, but I am a smooth man." And then the end of the A side, oh, LPs, remember those days. The end of the A side is The Aftermath of War. And this is probably the one piece that propelled them beyond just sort of comedy into genuine satire, the Beaverbrook stuff. As well. But this really, because there's this whole mythology, which again, in these Brexit times, is getting called upon again, this that sort of Dunkirk spirit. But this idea that everybody was, you know, pulling together and everything was great. And during the war, everything was just, you know, everybody hung together and everything was very smooth and all went well because we just knuckled down and did our best. And it parodies all that and all those films that were made. And again, wartime propaganda films that were trying to show this, you know, spirit of togetherness and this very, at times, very hokey sort of morality and sacrifice. And really, it punches holes through that in a very brilliant and very carefully skewered way, but also very, very funny. The football analogy of the, you know, Peter Cooke playing an officer taking aside one of his men and saying, "You know how it is when 10 men sometimes play better than 11 on the pitch, you know, and we're one man down. Well, we want you to be that one man. So, you know, fly over and get yourself killed." One of the running jokes that still comes up all the time for my brother and I is the fella who is I never used to hear the news. I was always out in the garden, you know, planting this or planting that. And my wife came out and told me the terrible news. And I told her, no, don't worry, you know, never mind. Put the kettle on. We'll have a nice cup of tea. And of course, in the last of these repeating bits, the last bit is hearing about rationing. And it's like, you know, put the kettle on and we'll have a nice cup of hot, boiling hot water. But it's, you know, in amongst all these other things about, you know, this mythology of the war. And again, very important that it's called the aftermath of war. That aftermath really hangs on for a long time in convincing people that during rationing that continued after the war and with other sort of societal controls going on, that, well, but it's all in the good, it's all in support of, you know, good old Britain, and we've got to really hang together and do this kind of thing. And the strength of that and the undermining of it that comes through this bit is really, really powerful. And it's, you can see why it had a real success with the audience. Another piece that quickly had a very popular response pulled on a character that actually Peter Cook had created in school, which he called sometimes Groke, but later became E.L. Wistie. But in this particular case, he's a coal miner. And the bit is called Sitting on the Bench. And it's a coal miner who talks about why he became a coal miner and not a judge. And of course, the reason is, well, I never had the Latin for the judging. And, you know, you need that for the exam in order to pass it. And he said, you know, the mining exam was not so rigorous. They only ask you, who are you? And I got 75% on that. And the interesting thing about this is that there are many versions of this particular piece that exist out there from various performances over time that Peter Cook had done over and over and over again. And they're all quite different. And apparently, since Alan Bennett was on, it's just, yeah, the more common one to come off my tongue, I guess. Because Alan Bennett would be on immediately after him, he got a little frustrated with Peter Cook because sitting on the bench could take anything from 5 minutes to 15 minutes, depending upon when he's, you know, one of these evenings, or he was just kind of rolling with it and creating new aspects of the story because it got into, you know, nude ladies and them going down the mine and trying to sell the story of his life to a publisher. If you see the video of the farewell performance of Beyond the Fringe, those elements have crept into that final performance of it. There's also, after on the LP, after Sitting on the Bench, is And the Same to You, which is the Colonel Bogey March done in the style of Beethoven. And one of the brilliant things about it is Dudley Moore creates this persona of the pianist playing it who's unable to come to the end of the song and keeps coming up with these sort of finishing touches, and then it doesn't quite end and it changes to a different one, and he keeps coming around and trying to get it to stop, and then finally just, you know, so kind of walks away from the piano. And it's really quite brilliant. There's another bit from Alan Bennett called Portrait from Memory, and there's sort of two different ones that he would do. And one was on T.E. Lawrence, and the other was on the philosopher G.E. Moore. And that's the one that's on this LP, unless I'm sadly mistaken. And it's another one that, again, just ingrained into memory so much that it's one that my brothers and I all know very, very well, too. And in large part, it's funny because it's very much based on this precision of language that is such a part of philosophy. Do you have some apples in that basket? No. Do you have apples in that basket? You know, and the difference between them and the responses. He said yes and smiled seraphically, as was his wont. And this, again, sort of almost the end of the second side of the LP, has another big sort of showpiece, like the opposite, The Aftermath of War, was So That's the Way You Like It, which is Jonathan Miller's Shakespeare parody, which again is just brilliant. And it's hard to do Shakespeare parody without being far too side on the parody side and not enough on the Shakespeare side, because it's awfully difficult to reproduce. But it is so many recognizable things in it, and so many recognizable aspects, and the names and the wars and the conversations, and then the in between moments, the when we go from the kings to the commoners, and we have the humorous like the grave diggers in Hamlet, where much more the style of humor is different too. So you have this much more sort of like bodily humor, and it's very funny. And Miller gets this balance between them just right. And again, that killer line of Saucy Worcester just really, really works in context. And then the final piece for this LP is the ever so fitting right now, The End of the World, which I initially saw, again, my memory and overlaps, but in Pleasure at Her Majesty's. So it was with Peter Cook, who did write this one. But it also had Python members, and it had Rowan Atkinson in the Dudley Moore part. And The End of the World is a story of a cult who climb up on the top of a mountain and prepare for the end of the world. The various questions they have for their leader, played by Peter Cook, and of course the Dudley Moore, in this case, playing a very, you know, gravelly voice sort of follower who's not very smart, which he tended to play a lot of those kind of characters. Question, will this wind? And Peter Cook, the very, very officious sort of cult leader, is like, it has to be a question, you're speaking too softly for the human ear, which is what I'm equipped with. Can you repeat your question? He's like, even softer, saying, well, this wind. He's like, well, that's no good. You know, what kind of a follower are you? I tell you to speak louder, you speak softer. It's, you know, very strange behavior at a follower. And so finally he gets out his question, which is, will this wind be so mighty as to lay low the mountains of the earth? He finally gets his question out. Peter Cook repeats his question. And he's like, well, no, of course not. That's why we've come up on this mountain, you nit. And, you know, we'll be here, up here, we'll be safe as houses. Well, no, the houses, they'll all be destroyed, but we'll be fine. So they're counting down the last minutes. And of course, nothing happens. And somebody, you know, it was GMT, right? And so they're like, well, we'll just do it again. Well, all right, come back tomorrow. And they go off. So again, it's a very interesting group of very, very different little sketches. The great thing about Beyond the Fringe is that it allows all of the performers to showcase their individual talents. But when they come together, they really create something special. And I think that's the strength of it, both in the original version and the version they took to New York and then brought back again to Britain. It's well worth checking out if you're not familiar with it. You can get it on recordings. You can also get the video, as I mentioned, of the final performance, which I was sitting watching last night to remember all of the things that were in it. And of course, that the show innovated as it went over time. All right, that's plenty for this episode, as they seem to be getting longer and longer. So I'll just thank you for listening and see you next time. Bye.